Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests today, Anatole Levin, will help us understand what's been going on in and around Ukraine, and Micah Utrecht will tell us all about how the historic Chicago teacher strike came to be and what labor can learn from its successes. First up, Anatole Levin. Levin is a professor of war studies at King's College London, a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, and author of Russia and Ukraine, A Fraternal Rivalry, which was published by the U.S. Institute of Peace in 1999. He's a former journalist with the Times of London and the Financial Times, who spent lots of time in the various territories comprising the former Soviet Union, as well as Afghanistan and Pakistan. I thought his calm, knowledgeable style would be very appropriate to help us figure out what's going on in Ukraine. Anatole Levin. Welcome, Anatole. It's been quite a while, but the events in Russia, Ukraine, etc., very confusing to those of us who do not know the region well. So, the conventional narrative in the United States is that Putin is, the new Saddam Hussein or something, only with a much bigger military on the march to take over everything, and we need to be tough. What do you think?
I wrote a book called Ukraine and Russia, A Fraternal Rivalry. I wrote it now almost 17 years ago. It came out in 1999. And so that was researched and written while Yeltsin, was still president of Russia. And what I said in that book was that, this is a very complex relationship between Ukraine and Russia, and that there are, elements of hostility, elements of close friendship. It depends on which bit of Ukraine. And that, as far as most of Ukraine was concerned, Russia would, in the end, have to let it go. But that there was one area: if Ukraine ever moved into a Western alliance seen by Russia as hostile to Russia, that Russia would seize back, and that was Crimea, and above all Sevastopol, of course, the old Russian naval port. Well, as I say, I researched and wrote that under Yeltsin in the 1990s. The CIA, in a famous report, warned of the possible breakup of Ukraine in the mid-1990s, in the time of Yeltsin. In other words, this is not actually new, nor is it specifically about Putin. It is about the way in which the Russian state elites see Russia, see Ukraine, and see the interests, and as they would see it, the rights of Russia in certain parts of Ukraine.
Now, the Russians, according to some accounts, feel rather surrounded by U.S. and NATO military bases. Is there some basis, in fact, for anxiety on their part?
Well, the United States did its utmost, supported by Britain, to try to get Georgia into NATO at a time when two bits of Georgia had broken away de facto, though not yet, de jure, and were under Russian military protection. Now, that in many ways was wrong, although, if you go back, to the origins of this in the 1990s, there's tremendous hypocrisy on all sides, because the West actually in many ways backed the secession of Armenian Nagorno-Karabakh from Azerbaijan because, of course, of the huge Armenian diasporas in California and Paris and so forth. But anyway, the U.S. was trying to get Georgia into NATO. It armed and supplied and trained the Georgian army. And in August 2008, for very understandable reasons, the president of Georgia ordered an attack, ordered the Georgian army to attack South Ossetia and try to drive out the Russian troops there. And, the Russian base there was surrounded. Several Russian soldiers were killed. Well, now, once again, I did, I warned the Deputy Secretary of State 3 years before that this was likely to happen, because it was so obvious. Now, the Georgians did that it was insanity otherwise, in the clear expectation that America would then come to their military aid if Georgia counterattacked. Now, of course, America was never going to do that any more than America will fight for Ukraine. But after that experience, it is not wholly irrational of the Russians, to see the United States, in the former Soviet Union as bitterly opposed to Russian interests and, willing to back some very, very anti-Russian and dangerous elements. Now, That, please, does not mean that I'm justifying what Russia has done in Crimea. I think that it's both a crime and a blunder, nor am I justifying Russia's original behavior in Abkhazia and South Ossetia, you know, the where ways of promoting, you know, a possible settlement with Georgia many years earlier. But the point is that these are dangerous issues and should be approached with care.
Let's go back to the uprisings in Ukraine, which were viewed by a lot of commentators in the U.S. as something like the Arab Spring come to Kiev. What did you see as going on in that period?
Well, I think there are three elements to keep in mind. The first is that this was a genuine uprising, you know, clearly with a great deal of mass support. And the most important element of that was a desire to join the West, you know, and not just to get away from Russia, but, you know, as part of the same thing, you know, a desire to get away from Ukraine's own horribly corrupt, you know, oligarchical system. So that's the first thing to recognize, you know, because, of course, Russian propaganda does not recognize that. The second thing, however, which the Russians greatly exaggerate, but, you know, they haven't invented it, that there is an element of truth in it, is that, of course, certainly when, you know, the Yanukovych government tried to crack down and the demonstrations turned violent, a very prominent part in this uprising came to be played by ultra-nationalist and, you know, in one case, actually neo-fascist volunteer groups. I'm talking about especially the Svoboda Party and Pravi Sector, Right Sector. And, you know, there was a resolution of the European Parliament in December of 2012. It is rather astonishing that this has not been more widely quoted, condemning Svoboda for ethnic chauvinism, anti-Semitism and xenophobia, and calling on Ukrainian democratic parties to form no alliances with Svoboda. Now, of course, they have four places in the new government in Ukraine. So, I mean, the Russians have greatly exaggerated the threat to Russian speakers and Russians in Ukraine, but they haven't invented it. I mean, there is a danger there. And the final point is that repulse, which, you know, means that it is not like the Arab Spring, and it's not like, you know, the revolutions in Eastern Europe in 1989, that Yanukovych was, of course, he did run a very repulsive and deeply corrupt government, but it was an elected government. You know, he had been elected in 2010, you know, in elections which Western observers certified as free and fair and legitimate. Well, you know, the thing is, in a democracy, you get rid of governments through elections, not by street revolution. The problem about street revolution is that, you know, it distributes power to people who are not necessarily Democrats. There is no question of bringing Yanukovych back. That's ridiculous. I mean, actually, even Putin recognizes that. But I think we can all agree that the sooner Ukraine has, you know, free and fair elections, independently monitored, you know, by which I have to say, I mean, not by... I mean, Western representatives should be there, but there have to be others as well. The better it will be for Ukraine's, you know, for the legitimacy of the government and the unity of Ukraine.
The discourse now around Putin in the United States is a weird revival of a feeling of the pre-Iraq invasion paranoia, plus some old Cold War tropes. And you got John McCain describing, was it Russia as a gas station masquerading as a country, and David Frum now parsing Putin's speech for you know, imperial ambitions. What do we make of these characters?
Well, I must say, I really, really loved the statement by Kerry, you know, that in the 21st century, one simply doesn't invade a sovereign state on a made-up excuse. Funny now, that reminded me of where, in particular? Could it be Iraq? You know, I mean, the levels of hypocrisy are absolutely staggering in some cases. I mean, that's the first thing. The second thing is that, as I said, Putin is doing essentially what Yeltsin would have done in similar circumstances, if, of course, you know, Russia had been stronger. As I say, I did write about this in under Yeltsin in the 1990s about what Russia would do in such circumstances. Now, that said, I mean, of course, it is quite true that there's an element of Russian imperialism about this. Certainly, the Putin government wishes to keep Ukraine within Russia's sphere of influence. The Eurasian Union was developed by Putin, you know, as a key way of maintaining Russian influence. Though, actually, it has to be said, I mean, it was the Eurasian Union is strongly supported by Kazakhstan, for example, which can't be accused of supporting Russian imperialism. There are also certain good economic and geopolitical reasons for this. But, I mean, it is now, I mean, I think it does, of course, absolutely need to be said that, I mean, what the uprising in Kiev shows is that this idea of is dead as far as Ukraine is concerned. It is quite absolutely obvious that Ukraine cannot be taken into a Russian-dominated union because a large number of Ukrainians will literally fight to the death to prevent that. So Putin's plans from this point of view are over and cannot be revived. Now, of course, what Putin is talking about is neutralization. You know, in other words, Ukraine doesn't join either bloc. Given that there does appear to be you know, a really serious risk, well, an obvious risk, that you know, by trying to drag Ukraine into one bloc or the other bloc, what you do is tear Ukraine apart. There may be room for, you know, some kind of compromise there, if only, you know, both sides would stop screaming at each other. But I think the point is that this whole thing is about Ukraine. There is no threat to Poland, to the Baltic states. There could be a threat to Moldova because of Transnistria, but I mean, but that too is part of the whole Ukrainian imbroglio, because of course, in the past, Russia has supplied Transnistria across Ukraine, which it will no longer be able to do. But I think what one needs to focus on is that, you know, I said this in an essay coming out shortly, Ukraine is not part of a wider Russian game. Ukraine is the game. The importance of Ukraine to Russia outweighs that of all the other former Soviet republics put together. You know, it actually outweighs, as we've seen, you know, a great part of Russia's relations with the West. You know, Ukraine is important in itself. So let's talk about how we can, you know, bring about a settlement within Ukraine that will, you know, also deprive Russia of any pretext for further intervention and prevent, you know, a possible war in Ukraine.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin of King's College London.
Is the annexation of Crimea fait accompli, irreversible? What's going to happen?
Yeah. I mean, it's not good. It is illegal. It was unnecessary. It's a mistake from Russia's point of view, a dreadful mistake. You know, if I were a member of the Russian foreign policy establishment, I would be contemplating suicide by now because of the extent of the error. But it's over. It's done. You know, once Russia has actually, according to its own laws, defined Crimea as part of Russia, then any, certainly any armed attempt to take it back will, by definition, be seen as war with Russia, and the Russians will fight. And you see, the thing is, if you start, you know, once the fighting starts, then, you know, as in so many wars, one doesn't know where it will stop. But I would be astonished if it stopped in Crimea.
And now, what about the Western response? I mean, they're huffing and puffing and imposing some sanctions, but how serious are these, and really, how much can the West do to Russia to make it change its mind?
Well, look, I mean, the first thing is, I think, which does have to be said very strongly, you know, America and Britain, and of course a number of other European countries as well, were trying to take Georgia into NATO. They were trying to take Ukraine into NATO. By doing so, they were drastically worsening the relations of these countries with Russia and increasing the Russian threat. And they have made it absolutely obvious twice now that there is no way that they will ever fight to defend these countries. Now, I mean, the word irresponsible does not even begin to describe that. I mean, and immoral, too. You know, you do not, you know, initiate these processes if you have no intention of actually keeping your promises. which we clearly are not. So that's the first thing to be said. We're not going to fight. When it comes to Crimea, I think that, as we've seen, the Western response has been very limited. And unless the Russians escalate in some drastic way, which they haven't done yet, they're still, supplying their gas to Ukraine and obviously to the West and so forth, I don't think that this has to lead to anything very much. There is, as I say now, no way whatsoever that the Russians will ever give Crimea back. I mean, that's just over. What the West absolutely has to do is to make it clear and credible to Russia that if Russia launches a military intervention in the rest of Ukraine, if it crosses the border into Donetsk and Kharkov and so forth, then that the West really will impose very, very tough economic sanctions. You see, the problem with this whole NATO business as well, and once again, look, this ain't rocket science. I've been saying it for years and years and years. By extending NATO to countries that you will not in the end defend, you are not strengthening NATO. What you're doing is giving Russia, but equally importantly as far as America is concerned, China, Iran, God knows who around the world, the idea that you will never in fact fight. Now, I don't think Russia has any ambitions as regards the Baltic states at present, but that doesn't mean that it's a good idea to give Moscow the feeling that we wouldn't even fight for the Balts. You see what I mean? Somehow we, without escalating the situation immediately over Crimea, which is lost, we have to credibly convince the Russians that there is a much, much, much more serious price to be paid if they go further into Ukraine. But I have to say, I mean, that does also, by the same token, involve us, reining in these ultra-nationalist militias in Kiev and elsewhere. Because, if you've read their propaganda, and looked at their websites, if you've met these people, they hate Russians. Not Russia, not Putin, they hate Russians. They hate the Russian language in Ukraine. They hate Russian culture. If these guys, are allowed, to move into Kharkov and Donetsk and so forth, then you will have massive and bloody clashes. Then I think Russia will intervene. And then you have war.
But a country that couldn't even conquer Iraq. I mean, the idea of war with Russia seems surreal and suicidal and just utterly disastrous.
Well, I would entirely agree with you. But our beloved government should have thought of that a bit earlier.
But then, talking about defending the Baltics, with what means? It's not like we can go to war over the Baltics, can we?
But, Doug, there is such a thing as honour. We have promised they are NATO members, they're European Union members. If we are not prepared to go to war to defend the Baltic, then we might as well hang up an enormous sign over the West saying, too decadent and gutless to keep, even the most solemn of promises.
That may be accurate, though, isn't it?
Well, I hope not, But I think, the point is, the Russians have an awful lot on their plate in Ukraine. I do not think that there is the slightest reason to fear that Russia will try to, extend this further in the foreseeable future, except, as I say, in this case of Transnistria, which is now becoming extremely menacing. So I think, the point should be to work out how both to, live up to our own responsibilities in Ukraine, which, as I say, I do think requires reining in the ultra-nationalists, develop a reasonable political settlement, not because Russia demands it, but because this is necessary for for democratic stability and progress in Ukraine, while developing the explicit threat of very, very severe concrete sanctions if Russia goes further. So that would be my advice.
If we lived in a rational world, which I guess, of course, we don't, what would the outlines of a solution to the Ukraine crisis look like?
I would say resignation of the political ministers of the interior and the army and the National Security Council, which is now headed by one of these ultra-nationalists, and their replacement by professional officers until after the next elections. elections to take place under United Nations supervision, so that, you know, neither the ultra-nationalist militias nor the pro-Russian militias, you know, are in a position simply to rig them and intimidate people in their own areas. And thirdly, I would say that the West, I mean, I wouldn't say with Russia, because given the feelings about Russia now, it's probably best just to do it ourselves, but should press upon Ukraine very urgently. And, you know, the point that Ukraine is now totally dependent on us for financial aid does give us great leverage here. A new constitution which will do two things. It will federalize Ukraine so that, you know, the different regions have genuine elected power. Because, you know, I mean, the thing is, everyone goes on about how in Russia the governors are appointed by the Kremlin. Well, so are they in Ukraine. It's the government in Kiev that appoints the local governors. They're not elected. Well, you know, I mean, hell, you know, there's nothing wrong with a federal system. America has it, Germany has it, India has it. And this coupled with, of course, a guarantee of official status for the Russian and other minority languages, you know, then reassures the Russians and Russian speakers of Ukraine and deprives Moscow of its pretext for further intervention. That's what I would advocate, as you say, in a rational world.
And you don't see Russia as having any great strategic designs beyond Crimea?
No, I think I don't think that Russia has, at least as anything like its first option, territorial designs beyond Crimea. It certainly has strategic designs. I mean, it wants to, now that Moscow has had to give up the idea of getting Ukraine into the Eurasian Union, clearly, I mean, Russian strategy is now to try to neutralize the place. But, you know, I have to say, you know, every opinion poll, you know, independent, certified, you know, by Western organizations, I think there was one by the International Republican Institute, over the years, you know, and right up to, you know, the edge of the present crisis, has shown that between 65% and 70% of Ukrainians oppose membership of NATO. They oppose membership of NATO, not the European Union. That's the other way around. But because they see it, you know, as bringing them no extra security, they had good reasons to think that NATO would never, in fact, fight for them. They saw the risk of, you know, it being dragged off to fight for America in Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever, and they knew that it would drastically worsen, you know, relations with Russia, which about half of the Ukrainians, at least until the present crisis, very much wanted to keep good relations with, you know, as well as good relations with the West. So you see, this shouldn't be seen as surrendering to Russia. You know, it should be seen as developing a reasonable policy to try to, you know, bring about compromises that avoid conflict in Ukraine, which, after all, you know, is what we have followed or tried to follow in so many other countries around the world. It's just that whenever Russia becomes involved, well, A, of course, Russia behaves very badly, but it also seems to have a capacity to drive many of our own analysts out of their wits.
As Anatole Levin, Professor of War Studies, what a bracing department name, at King's College, London. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
There are no cold in the sea. There are no cold in the Cayman. Did you honestly expect there to be? There are no Spanish in Malta. There are no stakes in the road. State of affairs and the loathing. No matter whatever we do.
Some of No Russians in Russia by the Radio Stars. Next up, Michael Utrecht, a Chicago-based journalist who's just out with a book called Strike for America, another volume in the joint venture between Verso Books and Jacobin, the radical magazine. It's the story of the Chicago Teachers Union strike against that city's schools in September 2012. Chicago has been a hotbed of neoliberal education reform, charterization, testing, union breaking, all under Democrats, including former school CEO Arne Duncan, now Obama's Secretary of Education, and Mayor Rahm Emanuel, a longtime Obama intimate. At the beginning of this interview, Micah and I discussed how charters have never lived up to their promise of better results, that despite refusing to accept special needs students and even kicking out underperformers. Their real purpose is to make entrepreneurs some money, cut salaries and other costs, and break unions. But I had to cut that discussion for length, so that's a summary. Okay, now on to Micah Utrecht.
Let's do some background scene setting first. Chicago. At the forefront of neoliberal school privatization schemes, right? Let us know what was going on in the run-up to the CTU strike.
There's a round of education reform that happens in the 1990s, tilling the soil for what was to come. But in the 2000s was the time when, you know, Arne Duncan was the CEO of Chicago Public Schools under Mayor Daley, Richard Daley. The big thing that comes out of Chicago is the Renaissance 2010 plan, which started in 2004 and resulted in a whole slew of school closures. There was initially going to be closing all these schools. After some pushback, they ended up doing what was called turnarounds, where they wouldn't close a school, but they would fire everyone from the lunch lady to the teacher in the building and turn it over to a private, like usually a charter operator. So there's, you know, tons of charters being built during this time. There's the growth of, you know, charter networks like UNO, the United Neighborhood Organization, which is a former Alinskyite community organization that ends up running charter schools and creating this sort of Latino patronage machine in the city. All the while, sort of, you know, there's a national consensus sort of building around free market education reform. You know, this is happening during a time when the Democratic Party nationally is shifting to the right on education reform.
Now, the theory behind the closures is sort of a creative destruction theory brought in from neoliberal economics, right?
Right.
Close some schools and it will clear the way for somehow success will rise out of the ashes.
Mm-hmm.
We're not clear on how that was going to work exactly, though.
Yeah, right. There's no real proof that that's going to actually, you know, improve education in any way. And in many ways, it creates all kinds of upheaval for students. I mean, obviously, teachers are left without jobs. But students, you know, in many communities, the closures have happened in mainly African American communities in Chicago, and you know, these closures are of institutions that are really sort of very important institutions in these communities.
So the union, the Chicago Teachers Union, which was the first, it is Local One of the
right.
AFT, right?
It's, yes.
It was the origin of the American Federation of Teachers.
Yeah, in the early part of the 20th century, there were a number of unions that came together to form the Local One, Chicago Teachers Union.
And until rather recently, it had been run by a bunch of hacks.
Yes, in the 70s, there were a number of racial justice caucuses that came together to fight around a number of the issues that were facing teachers of color, and who took not only the issues facing teachers of color seriously, but the issues of students of color very seriously, and we're interested in the kind of broad-based unionism that could not only fight for themselves but for students. But long story short is that caucus, the United Progressive Caucus, over the years after leading the union out through a number of strikes in the 70s and 80s, had grown pretty ossified and had no interest in building any kind of resistance to the new sort of consensus on school reform that was coming down from Arne Duncan, and was,
well, they're pretty much playing along with it. It wasn't a matter of not resisting, but
yeah, there's, you know, I quote a scene in the book where the union leadership says that they agree with this plan that's been floated, that, you know, in order to improve teaching in the city of Chicago and cities elsewhere, that 10% of teachers need to be fired. That's their sort of solution, which is a solution that comes straight from the free market reformers of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think Goldman Sachs' practice used to be to fire the bottom 15% of performers every year.
Well, 5% less for the public education, yeah.
Regular rounds of firings will encourage the others, presumably.
Right, the market logic applied to public education. And
one, for a union to endorse exactly, mass firings is a remarkable event.
Yeah, and in speaking to folks who had been around the union for a while in writing the book, I remember the line that someone used when they were talking about all these attacks that were coming on Chicago teachers was that their union leadership wasn't just asleep at the wheel, they were joyriding. The union leadership paid itself lavish salaries, and so they're sort of enjoying the perks of being at the head of this union while teachers, rank-and-file teachers, are being fired, and there's all kinds of upheaval in the Chicago public schools, and then they're doing very, very little about it. Are even fighting attempts by rank-and-file teachers in order to fight this agenda. Rank-and-file teachers are the ones who are trying to convince the union that they need to be fighting school closings, the union will set up some kind of committee to supposedly address this, but then they'll immediately put the kibosh on the committee.
And, of course, it should be pointed out that Arne Duncan gets promoted to be Secretary of Education in 2009. So the Chicago model goes national.
Yeah.
And being embraced and promoted by Democratic president. Now, people always think this is a conservative agenda. It is now thoroughly bipartisan. The Democrats are as deeply involved as anyone.
Yes.
There was an important moment when Jonah Adelman was caught giving an indiscreet speech, right?
Yes, that's right. Although we should back up, one thing that's sort of interesting about the CTU specifically and the attempts to reform the union comes long before that. You know, this old guard leadership that we were speaking about is at the head of the union for the bulk of four decades, and there was an attempt in the early 2000s to reform the union. People were getting increasingly impatient with their union leadership, and there's another caucus of the union called PACT that decides to challenge union leadership and wins in 2001 and sees themselves as being less corrupt and more competent than the union leadership that they were replacing, but doesn't see any kind of need to change their relationship with rank-and-file members of the union themselves, doesn't see any need for much of anything besides more competent leadership. After one term, they are summarily booted by their members as a result of negotiating a contract that wasn't much better than the ones that the old, more corrupt guard was negotiating. So before we get to the point where this caucus, the Caucus of Rank-and-File Educators that Karen Lewis is the president of, was the candidate of, Chicago teachers have an example of reform that didn't work and saw what kind of changes they would have to make among their union leadership's relationship to the members themselves. It couldn't just be someone better at the top.
Now, I'm blurring the chronology. The Adelman speech was before or after the transition to the new leadership?
That was in 2011. That was right at the time of the transition to the new.
Okay, so how did this new leadership cadre form itself?
It's a really long-term project. I say in the book that there's not any kind of shortcut, probably, to creating the kind of unionism that's come out of the Chicago Teachers Union. People who had been involved in this liberal reform effort that failed in the early 2000s, folks on the left within the union, just sort of rank-and-file teachers who were not content to watch their watch public education be dismantled and see their union doing nothing about it, start to, instead of going directly to the union, because that appears to be a dead end, start organizing alongside community members in neighborhoods of color who are organizing against things like Renaissance 2010.
The charter movement loves to present itself as what the new civil rights movement, all that stuff. And they've developed this quite an astroturf structure of black and Latino supporters. This is proven time and time again to be about an inch deep, right?
Yeah, but on the other side of that, teachers' unions have not done a very good job of countering that in any way. And Chicago is a perfect example. There are huge groups of communities of color who are organizing against these education reform plans. And the union is actively trying to squash efforts to link them to the teachers' union. When teachers' unions or any kind of union do that, it allows an opening for people like these education reformers to step in and claim that they're the civil rights heroes of the 21st century. They're the ones who are fighting for kids of color.
To be honest, you have to admit that unions do help create their bad
press. Exactly. Yes. Right.
It does no good to deny that fact.
Right, which is what these group of rank-and-file educators are trying to change about the way the union acts. So
this is a small group of people within the union who don't like what's going on.
Yeah, and it starts off with just a couple sort of average rank-and-file teachers who begin going to hearings where schools are going to be closed as part of the Renaissance 2010, approaching people who get up to speak, talking to them afterwards, and sort of very slowly interacting with those people in the community groups and slowly building an organization of people who you have teachers and of community members who are opposed to these education reform plans.
What years were we talking about?
This is the mid-2000s, during the height of the years of Renaissance 2010, and right after the reform effort within the union has failed.
Okay, so they're building this small organization, developing ties with community organizations, and how did they manage to recruit more members within the union?
I mean, there were large numbers of people who were dissatisfied with the union leadership and what the union was doing, but didn't quite know how to fix that. Over this period of several years, this group core starts doing the kinds of things that the union leadership should have been doing themselves, right? Holding public forums, and they end up successfully getting several schools removed off of the school closure list several years in a row, which had never been done before, which the union had never even tried to do previously. So they're winning sort of tangible victories as just this independent group of rank-and-file teachers without any kind of official backing from their union, and people are seeing these real results, and the interest in the caucus grows and grows and grows up until closer to the time in 2010, closer to the election, when they realize that they actually might be able to run for leadership in the union and win. And I talk about in the book how CORE was actually encouraged by these community members themselves to run for the leadership of the union. After they had won these victories, like getting these schools off the closure list, community members started saying, well, it's great that we've been able to do this, but think about what we could do if we had the full weight and full resources of the union behind us. And so that decision to run for union leadership in 2010 comes from at the behest of the community members themselves.
I'm speaking with Micah Utrecht, author of Strike for America, just out from Verso.
Which is interesting, because now I'm recalling reading Mark Mayer's History of Municipal Unions in New York City, City Unions, and he says in there that one of the things that New York City, and this is the early 60s, one of the things that the city administration wanted to make sure of was that there was no alliance between the municipal unions and the public to improve the quality of public services.
Right, because...
And in most cases, city governments have been very successful in preventing those sorts of alliances from developing, but in this case... This was the source of strength for the new caucus in the union.
Municipal level governments want to prevent municipal unions from doing that because they recognize how powerful those coalitions can be. And they certainly, in the 21st century, they recognize that at a time when public sector workers are so demonized, that if public sector workers are fighting alongside the users of those services, then that shatters that myth that they're defending their right to be lazy and to be overpaid.
So this CORE caucus then just develops, grows and grows, develops community ties, develops support within the union, and they finally win the leadership, right?
Yes, in 2010.
And how do we go from there to the strike?
There's lots of interesting things that happen in that two-year period between when they win leadership of the union in 2010 and when they go on a strike in 2012. The main thing to understand, they had seen the example of reformers in the past who had not really involved the rank and file in their reform efforts. There was sort of reform from above. And so the main thing they start doing is creating structures in the union that had never existed before to recruit and develop leadership among rank and file teachers themselves, among the 26,000 members of the CTU. They create an organizing department that had never existed before. They very consciously attempt to move away from that kind of litigious unionism, away from filing grievances. They encourage members themselves to be equipped to deal with their sort of day-to-day problems at the school level, taking on principals who are bullying them or who they have problems with. And they start doing very serious political education about things like tax increment financing in the city, which is this sort of...
Within the union or broader public?
Within the union specifically, they're training teachers on these issues that are of interest to the sort of broader working class in Chicago. And time making ties between what's going on with tax increment financing, which is a sort of shady public financing scheme that takes money from public resources like schools, and sort of tying that to what's going on in their schools on a day-to-day level. So there's political education, there's sort of an increased level of democracy within the union, there's a serious attempt to increase the organizing structures such that every single teacher in every single school, all 26,000 members, is really hearing about what's going on in the union and encouraged to get involved. And they're building their own caucus as well. The caucus is where teachers are getting a much more kind of explicit of political education.
So what then provoked the strike?
Right when the Corps was elected in 2010, there was an admittance on behalf of some of the leadership that they would probably have to go on strike when they go to negotiate their contract in 2012. What was being demanded of them in 2012 was kind of insane. I mean, the district wanted to do things like remove caps on class sizes. They were trying to get teachers to work longer hours with this longer school day that Rahm Emanuel had been pushing for the same amount of pay. There's an effort by Rahm Emanuel to introduce merit pay. The wish list for free market education reformers was on the table.
There had been changes in the state law that required an overwhelming vote in favor of authorizing the strike, which the state and the city thought the union could never meet, right? And they more than met it.
Yes, which is an interesting story that happens right when Corps takes office. It happens in 2011. They're sort of just a few months out of winning the union election. For some people like Karen Lewis, just a few months out of a classroom, right? They're teaching chemistry for several decades. The free market education reformers, specifically this person, Jonah Adelman, who was the head of Stanford Children, which had recently come into Illinois and which is one of these free market education reform groups.
Who, it should be pointed out, is the son of liberal royalty, Marion Wright Adelman and Peter Adelman, right?
Mm.
So he's almost symbolizes personally what's happened to the liberal Democrats.
He and his organization enter Illinois and at the behest of Bruce Rauner, who is now the Republican candidate for governor.
Retired hedge fund dude.
That's right, yes.
Hedge fund guys are all over this.
It's true. This is a real pet project. They've sort of taken it up as a hobby, and so especially in retirement, you know, instead of playing golf, Bruce Rauner is, you know, trying to destroy public education in America. But so they pushed this bill at the state level in Illinois, and it's a really sort of draconian bill that would have made striking illegal. And this famous tape that leaked after the bill passed is Jonah Adelman at the Aspen Ideas Festival, explaining to people who are gathered how they pulled a fast one over the Chicago teachers and how they got this bill passed. The change was that rather than needing a simple majority of votes in order to go on strike, the union would need 75% of all members.
Whether they voted or not.
Yes, whether they voted or not. So if people didn't vote, it would count as a no vote, right? In order to strike. So he's sort of smug in his feeling that means that the teachers are never going to be able to go on strike. They had examined numbers from the past and seen that past union leadership had never been able to get anything approaching a majority in a strike vote. So they felt confident that the teachers would never be able to go on strike. And an interesting story that I talk about in the book is of how the caucus reacts to this at the time. That sort of speaks to, I think, the level of principle of the leadership of the union. I mean, Karen Lewis and the union leadership signs on to this bill, and it's an odorous bill. The first round of it would have made it impossible for the teachers to go on strike. She comes back from Springfield, the state capital, having given the union's endorsement on this bill, and the rank and file says, "We can't abide this. This is horrible. Why weren't we consulted on this? Blah blah blah." It would have been easy, I think, for the caucus at that moment, with the old guard still waiting in the wings, certainly would have been excited to pounce on any kind of mistake made by these radical reformers who had just taken over the union. It would have been easy for the caucus to sort of rally around their leadership and back them up, even though they thought they had made a horrible decision in endorsing this bill. But they say, no, you're going to have to go back to Springfield and renegotiate these horrible parts of this bill. And to the union leadership's credit, they agree and sort of go back hat in hand to Springfield and say, you know, our membership has said that we can't endorse this bill and we're going to have to renegotiate parts of it, which is how we end up with the 75% threshold that was eventually decided upon in the bill. But some of the more draconian parts of the bill were lost after they went back and demanded the renegotiation.
So, but then the strike vote got, what, 90%?
90% of all members and 98% of the voting members. And, you know, to be honest, I, as someone who was watching this very closely, even a few months before the strike, never thought that they would be able to reach those kind of numbers, that 75% of all members thing. But it speaks to the development of their, you know, membership that they were able to reach that goal, reach that number. Before the caucus had taken control and before they had introduced all these kind of new democratic measures and had done this kind of development of rank and file members and gotten them involved in the day-to-day functioning of the union in a way that they never had before, that 75% vote would have been impossible.
They do go on strike, and it turns out being fairly popular with the public. I mean, you tell some stories in the book of getting, what, free cup of coffee and getting on a bus for free just because you're wearing a red shirt.
Right. It's difficult, I think, for people who were outside of Chicago at the time to understand the sort of feeling in the air of the city at that time. I mean, if you spend any time on a picket line, you could barely talk over the sort of roar of supportive honks coming from people on the street. Anyone wearing a red T-shirt anywhere is sort of getting solidarity fists from, you know, just average Joes on the street. And polls, multiple polls at the time show that the majority of Chicagoans backed the CTU in the strike, including sort of incredibly one that showed two-thirds of Latino and African-American CPS parents backing the strike at the exact time when they're being forced to find, you know, alternative arrangements for child care. But the union had effectively shown that they are not just out for themselves, but that they were sort of fighting on behalf of all of Chicagoans, that they were leading this movement for educational justice. And I think some people think of that as, I remember Dylan Matthews from the Washington Post, I heard him talking about how the union won the PR battle on this, without realizing that it wasn't just a PR battle, it was day-to-day interaction with these communities, knocking on doors in communities of color, working with these community organizations in neighborhoods of color. It was sort of very real interaction with the broader working class of Chicago that led to this widespread support.
Obviously, the struggle is not over. ROM is not going to give up. The neoliberals are not going to give up on their agenda. But it did and still feels like a victory, and don't really feel very many of those these days. Is what happened there replicable elsewhere?
Well, it's certainly not a kind of blueprint that you can just lay onto other cities, but the really important thing about the strike speaks to the base condition of the American labor movement, which is that there were all kinds of things that were lost in that contract and lost during the strike, but there was a kind of sort of stiffening of the spines of teachers nationally, I think, and many American unionists. I mean, in the wake of the strike, I think teachers, for the first time, are able to sort of articulate what they're up against. I think for years there's been a kind of incoherent seething about how teachers are treated nationally in the sort of public discourse about education reform. But in the wake of the strike, I think more and more teachers are starting to name the attacks on public education as part of this, you know, attempt to dismantle public education as part of this broader neoliberal project in the United States. As I said, in some places, teachers are starting to create organizations, rank-and-file caucuses like CORE. And, you know, I say at the end of the book that right after the strike happened, and the strike is this sort of clear victory for the teachers, but just a few months after it happened, Rahm Emanuel successfully closes 50 Chicago public schools. That summer, there's $162 million worth of classroom-level budget cuts that get pushed through. You know, it was an unequivocal victory, but it wasn't enough to prevent these closures and these budget cuts. But if the American labor movement is going to be able to push back on some of these things, it's going to take the kind of unionism that acts on behalf of the entire working class and that isn't just out for itself, that sees itself as an anchor of a broader movement. We have an example, I think, that other folks can run with in other places, and it's my hope that the book can help contribute to spreading that story and show how it was just, you know, it wasn't some, this wasn't sort of manna from heaven. This was just rank and file teachers who were fed up with their union who took it over and helped lead this amazing battle.
How's Michael Utrecht, author of Strike for America, the story of the Chicago Teachers Union and its historic 2012 strike against neoliberal education reform. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this 1988 anthem of youthful complaint from the Godfathers. Till next week, bye.
Talks are off the